audience, I'm so glad, we are delighted to be back here today. And I'm speaking from New Delhi, India. This is Nupur Ray. And we present to you today episode number 6 of our podcast series, Gender-Based Violence Contexts and Contestations. Through the journey that we have had, I think we had about 5 episodes where we have tried to unpack different dimensions, contexts, debates related to different aspects of what do we understand by gender-based violence. So its association with kind of climate justice and gender justice, the theoretical frameworks, the understanding and reflections in terms of understanding violence within a setup of home, within religious communities. So we have had a few important, significant deliberations as we have kind to try to align with what collaborative social change does. This podcast, a series, is an initiative by Collaborative Social Change. And it's an organization which through its activism, deliberations, policy, inclusive frameworks, tries to address and prevent diverse forms of widespread, direct, structural, and cultural forms of violence in everyday lives of women and other transgender identities, as well as to more severe mass atrocities, genocides, war crimes against humanity. So with that purpose, with that goal, I think we got on with this podcast series, and it is such an honor and privilege that we have today with us, Professor Diana Fox. The larger theme of our session today is gender-based violence and women's agency, voices from the field. Before we get on with our conversation with Professor Fox, we would like to introduce her to our audience today. So a brief introduction. Professor Fox is an interim university director at the Institute for Gender and Development Studies at the regional headquarters of the University of the West Indies in Jamaica, on leave as of now as professor of anthropology at Bridgewater State University, US. He's a cultural and applied anthropologist, decolonial feminist scholar, activist, and documentary film producer. Her scholar activism in Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaican has spanned over 2 to 3 decades respectively, with her research in Jamaica beginning in the 1990s when she was a graduate student at the University at Hampstead. Her scholar activism focuses on issues of gender role socialization, gender justice and sexuality, indigenous people's resilience, indigenous women's knowledges, women's social movement activism for ecological sustainability, women's human rights, and transnational feminism. In 2015, her research has expanded to women's issues in Asia, particularly Nepal, Kashmir, and Japan. She also happens to serve on a number of boards and committees, including the International Advisory Board of the Fondis Amandus Community Reforestation Project in Trinidad and Tobago, the Sexualities Working Group of the Caribbean Studies Association, the Board of the Friends of Association of Dalit Women's Advancement Nepal. She also serves as Deputy President to the International Institute of Knowledge Management in Sri Lanka, where she also worked as conference chair of the World Conference on Women's Studies since 2015. As academic advisor to the United Maroon Indigenous Peoples since 2017, she seeks to illuminate the nature of indigeneity in the Caribbean region, advocating for indigenous self-determination. She's a founding editor of the Open Access Online Journal of International Women's Studies, which was launched in 1999, and is the recipient of 4 Fulbright scholarships as well as other grants and awards. We welcome you, Professor Fox. I think, as I said before, it's indeed an honor today because the range of work that we have just kind of figured out in terms of your scholarship, your activism, your work with indigenous peoples, women collectives, I think is really going to give us a very, very enriching insight into understanding gender-based violence, but not just understanding the concept, the idea, but also the way in which, the groups, communities, and collectives are trying to challenge and address and prevent, these forms of violence discrimination, oppression, and so on. So welcome to our podcast series. Welcome to Collaborative Social Change. You know, it's kind of interesting that we just had August 9 as International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples. And we have you with us today because your rapporteur says that you have very intensely and very in kind of real, involved way worked and has been working, you know, with Indigenous women's collectives and people in different parts of the world, but especially looking at Nepal, Japan, and Jamaica. But foremost, I kind of really see you as an academic scholar. You know, I've also been through the Journal of International Women's Studies. And there are some very important theoretical interventions that we see. There's also some important conceptual explorations, you know, that also I happen to hear at the keynote address. So therefore, let us start from there, that what we understand from your work is an idea of decolonizing feminist discourses, right? And as much as we have theoretically explored in terms of moving away from what is called as a very mainstream Western, under the Western eyes, you know, as put up by Gayatri Spivak, we have moved away and we are trying to decolonize, you know, and enter into the spaces of what is called as indigenous forms of knowledge, indigenous forms of activism, indigenous forms of understanding agency. Could you please also, from your work and your scholarship, let us first unpack, you know, the idea of decolonizing feminist discourses from your perspective?
Well, thank you so much, Shukar. It is just a pleasure and an honor to be here with you to have this conversation, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and the audience, and thank you for the invitation. Your question is a large question. What is the nature of decolonizing feminism from my perspective? And let me just start with an example before I go into the broader framework of it. The example I'd like to share, building on your attention that you brought to us of the World Indigenous Peoples Day on August 9th, is the fact that up until quite recently, there was a discourse in the region, in the Caribbean region, that there were no Indigenous peoples. This is a discourse or a narrative of extinction, of invisibilization, of disappearance, and that is a form of violence. And when I first arrived in the region in 1991 as a graduate student, I absorbed that narrative. This is what people told me, and this is what I believed. And it wasn't until some voices of Indigenous peoples themselves, and in Jamaica, that voice was a woman's voice, Erica Ngedjuwejen, who was a Taino, Black Taino woman, who decided that it was time to raise her voice and to contradict that dominant narrative. So decolonizing, first and foremost, has to do with the way that we look at the world. And the way we look at the world is shaped by ideologies, by hegemonic discourses that are propelled by governments in their narratives of patriotism and nationalism, propelled by corporations in our late capitalist world. And all of that has origins in the what is known in Europe as the era of exploration that led to the current domination of European societies and American society through much of the world. So decolonizing in itself, and let me just say that the West has not been the only force of colonization. We know that there have been forces of colonization globally in the East, Japan, of China and Korea, China of Tibet, and right now the Uyghurs. India, of course, Kashmir and other spaces. Colonization is not, an imperialism is not owned by the West. And I think that's important because there tends to be a reductionist narrative about what colonization is. Just as we need to unpack the overgeneralizations of all peoples and concepts, so too we need to do so with the West. What is the West? And what do we mean when we refer to the West? And asking that question itself is a part of the decolonizing discourse, because what we want to understand are the ways in which these sources of power that I've just mentioned, whether they're imperial governments, whether they're religious organizations, corporations, have influenced not only the way in which we think about the world, but the way in which our actions, behaviors have been regulated by, or in Foucauldian terms, disciplined through colonizing thought and praxis. And there are many scholars who have suggested ways to go about unpacking. There's an entire Marxist analysis. Althusser has talked about the ideological apparatus of the state, right? And there are many other other frameworks. But when we bring in a feminist dimension, what we're trying to understand specifically are the ways in which colonial discourses, and I use the term discourse in its broadest post-structuralist sense, as harnessed by Edward Said and others to describe a whole body of thought and action, art, for example, an Orientalist art that converges around a set of ideas and reproduces those ideas and ways of being and thinking and doing to make them real in some effect. And so when we talk about unpacking feminist the coloniality that has impacted women, gender roles, diverse genders and sexualities, what we're trying to do is understand the ways in which systems of domination have given rise to particular kinds of patriarchies, particular kinds of dominances that are intersectional with class systems that emerged in the colonial period, with ideologies of race and ethnicity, with the imposition of Christianity. So all of these interacting, intersecting forms of thought and action or praxis have shaped the way the world today. And decolonial feminism seeks to understand how they have been shaped, specifically with respect to gender discourses, and to work to undo them, as well as to revive those forms of those cultural forms, those ways of being that are liberatory, that have been repressed through the colonial process. Decolonial feminism isn't about some nostalgic going back to. It is a combination, a blend of reviving and moving forward, because we are in a different world today. We're in a world that is faced by climate crisis. We're in a world that is existing in late capitalism, which is very different from the early period of coloniality. We are in a world that is undergoing a revival of an arms race. There are all kinds of forces that we must contend with today to understand the way in which historically and today systems of thought and behavior have been shaped that are oppressive, and how they can be undone and transformed into liberatory and emancipatory ways of being.
Thank you, Professor Fox. I think that was a very interesting way to enter into, you know, now the deliberation, because the larger theoretical framework within which we have placed our theme today is decolonizing, and that will help us to unpack ideas further. So therefore, in the same vein, may I then kind of ask you to reflect as to then how do we understand, or how did you understand in your research and work the concept of patriarchy, if that's the term to be used, gender relations, power dynamic within the indigenous communities that you work with? Or you think that the way we understand the family relations, community relations, property relations, interpersonal, or one can say, relationship with one's partner, is it something which is again coming the way we perceive them, the way we understand them, is something which needs more interrogation, more substantive reflection before we kind of really try to again, put them in our own categories of, academic scholarship? So is there anything deeper that we need to understand there?
Well, as Gramsci noted, hegemony is absorbed. And for the most part, until we are made aware of those systems of thought and the structures that propel them, we are not aware of them. And so life is a journey of continually becoming through self-reflexive processes, through being aware of and paying attention to our preconceived notions, to our biases and our stereotypes. And that's not an easy process. Brain science, in fact, is identifying the source of unconscious bias. And the brain likes to organize material into categories. And when those categories are coming from ways of thinking that are reductive, that are discriminatory, that are based on, for example, the idea, the 19th century idea of cultural evolution, which placed groups in a hierarchy from savagery to barbarism to civilization, with support and direction from the colonial discipline of anthropology, then it is a lifelong process for individuals to undergo this kind of cognitive and emotional unpacking of the ways in which these systems of thought shape us. For myself, as a decolonial feminist anthropologist, I've had to contend with the reality that my discipline was born, as many disciplines were, in the colonial period as a colonial discipline. Anthropologists, the first anthropologists, were colonial administrators. And in the mid 21st century, there was a sort of looking at the discipline, a self-reflexive historical moment of assessing this history and the way in which the discipline had been structured and the impact of that structure on representation of so-called others, right? Exotic others who were framed through this, not only this cultural evolutionary schema that I just mentioned, but other kinds of theoretical frameworks that were problematic in various ways, such as structural functionalism and the like. So as my identity as a decolonial feminist anthropologist has emerged over time through being in the field. My early field work in the 90s, when I was a graduate student, was not framed through that lens. Even though I had been trained in the emerging decolonial framework, it was emerging. And so it came, it evolved, it came over time, and it came through. One thing I will say for anthropology is that it is an empirical approach. So theories ostensibly should emerge from the process of doing field work. And so my early work was quite observational, through participatory research. Participant observation is the primary methodology, learning by participating, by doing, through various forms of interviews that are kind of check and balance with those observations, because observations are filtered through a cultural lens. As the observer, I am going to perceive what I am observing through a framework, which anthropologists have called ethnocentrism. Sometimes it's for depending on the observer, there can be a sexist or racist framework. So in my early work, I tried to understand what were the nature of gender roles in rural Jamaica. How did those gender roles emerge? I observed patterns of behavior. I just talked with people about the process of becoming an adult woman or man from childhood. What is the nature of socialization and enculturation of girls and boys? And how are people resisting those or challenging those ideals, those societal ideals? And then when I started to ask, where do those societal ideals come from? What are their sources? That's where the colonial framework started to emerge, because it is in the Caribbean, it's very tied up with the imposition of the colonial state, and which was also tied up with the church, the Anglican church in English-speaking Caribbean, where I was working and have been working, but also in the French Caribbean, Catholicism, Spanish Caribbean Catholicism. But then the Caribbean was a battleground for European states. And so many, many islands were British, or first Spanish, then French, then British, then Dutch. You know, they went back and forth in these battles, because they were battles for sugar. They were battles for resources. This was the point of departure for enslavement of Africans, and then later for indentureship of East Indians. And of course, even before that, the early enslavement of the first peoples. And so as I continued to do my research over the years, I learned about, and this is even before I became aware that there were still living active groups of first peoples, that there were groups called Maroons. Maroons are communities of self-liberated, formerly enslaved peoples. And today Maroons are their descendants who established communities in what's called grand marinage. Wherever there was African enslavement, there was marinage. And we can even refer to the first peoples as participating in marinage, because they escaped enslavement as well. And many of those communities intermingled and intermarried with one another. So as I learned about these processes of the movement of peoples, of the challenges to the colonial powers, I became interested in how various social groups were redefining themselves and looking towards their ancestry, as well as ways to reclaim a self-determined way of life and a future that reflected their values and beliefs. It was particularly feminist in that I was interested in how women were doing this, and I approached my research through a decolonial lens, not by simply arriving in communities and saying, this is what I'm interested in and I want to do a study, but through the lens of partnership. So anthropology has challenged that self-other duality, the self being the anthropological self, the other being the exotic other understudy, through the lens of partnership. We no longer talk about, or very few, some of us do, but those of us who embrace decoloniality don't refer to our field, our those whom we work with as informants, but as partners, as collaborators, in joining a shared course of research that benefits those who are whose communities are under that process of research, with a goal, with a transformative goal in mind. Research needs to be connected to liberatory action. And so it is, that is why I call myself also a scholar activist. I am not in the business of producing knowledge for knowledge's sake so that it can go into some book somewhere and not be absorbed and then put out into the world in a transformative way that tries to, for example, challenge the received notions of what it means to be a woman or a man, the nature of sexuality. And all of these things need to be challenged and questioned as to their sources and understood in terms of how going forward, these constructs can create communities that are sustainable, that are supportive, that allow for self-determination and the full thriving of all human beings and the living planet around us that we are part of.
Thank you. I think in a kind of really short and brief way, you know, we have touched upon some very important points. And in fact, now that we have kind of perhaps, looked at certain theoretical terrains, I think now we can come closer to the title of our, the session today, and which is actually looking at voices from the field. And that is something that you just kind of also reflected and made our audience familiar with today. In the work that I was kind of reading in, and therefore, of course, your intense engagement and involvement and participatory research with, Maroon Collective, Indigenous women, as well as I think there's also a documentary, that you had, kind of worked on looking at the LGBT Pride celebrations in Jamaica, right, 2015. So again, coming to more in terms of, because now there's a new language, or one can say perhaps there is a refined language, reworked language of women's movement. And that is in terms of claiming, agency, claiming collective agency. There's also a shift in what one could call as the method and the goal, where we are now going from the claims of ethics of justice to ethics of care. Now the space of rights is there and the space of, political participation is there, but along with that, there is also celebration of solidarity, of sisterhood, of empathy, of standing for each other. So do you think in some way the movements that you covered are in a very significant way contributing to the shifting of the language? And that has something to do with the way, because women are here, women, they speak in that language without essentializing it, but can we say that one of the things that women bring in is this language of empathy and the language of solidarity, and as I said, it is no longer just the state-owned words of empowerment and development, but it is something which is more intimate that is felt by women, and that's why and that is where that transformation then begins to happen, because that is where it has touched them, in terms of their being together. So is there anything that you would like to kind of comment around this?
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point. And in some ways, the language of empowerment has been appropriated by the state and by development agencies. So it began, as a grassroots concept, as did the concept of solidarity, which predates feminism. But solidarity it goes back to revolutionary discourse, and we see it in many revolutions, from the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the labor rights, you know, the communist revolution. So these ideas of you know, vive la résistance, you know, and the solidarity behind that is an old concept. But there are ways in which feminists are claiming that language along with the language of care. And I think care, the ethic of care, is very much a feminist concept. And I think it's emerged because part of the process of feminist resistance is a process that has pushed against exclusions. And so the process of that process of pushing against exclusions, whether it's changing legislative agendas, whether it's moving women into the workplace, whether it's the workplace, meaning the formal sector of paid labor, because the home is certainly a workplace of, you know, and socialist feminists for a long time have pushed for remuneration in the workplace, but as in the home as a workplace, but that those steps that have required the exertion of energy and very direct action, you know, around inclusivity and penetrating patriarchal male-dominated spaces has also led to women's double or triple burden, you know, working. So it hasn't necessarily transformed, although that's starting to happen, the relations of labor in the home of child care, and even in the formal workplace, women have often taken on the role of caregivers. So they're the ones who, in the academy, you know, who hear the stories of students and their struggles, who are caregivers for their colleagues, who have the ear of everyone, you know, and this is true, you know, across women's lives. And so what that means is that by incorporating women into spaces that were traditionally masculine spaces, where women still nonetheless have taken on work that is feminized work, and that has become burdensome. That's, again, the double burden, triple burden. Triple often refers to another layer of discrimination. So, for instance, Black women in the workplace in the United States, where they also are experiencing the burden of racism, you know, on top of gender discrimination, work in the workplace and in the formal workplace, and then work in the home, where these are all coming together and creating demands that are exhausting. And so how do social movements continue to make transformations, continue their critique when there's mass burnout, you know, when there's and also self-defense around sexual harassment or gender-based violence, you know, so the ethics of care have emerged in response to all of these dynamics. And with the groups that I work with, they have a particular configuration because the Maroons, for instance, are involved in trying to understand the ways in which their communities have interacted with the colonial state, the post-colonial state, which is still a colonial state, and the while contending with the intergenerational trauma of enslavement and a constant need to be vigilant as fugitives from enslavement, and The violence that accompanied all of that, both in the resistance to enslavement and then the violence of slavery itself. So the ethics of care have emerged in women-led social movements around freedom for Maroons in terms of not the importance of not dwelling exclusively on narratives of trauma, on and recognizing the creative and celebratory aspects of their life ways. So, you know, African societies have introduced all forms of artistry into societies, from drumming and dancing and singing, performance, very particular characters from folklore. For example, in Caribbean carnivals, there are Moko Jumbies who are stilt walkers, though they have origins in West Africa, and they are the forces of good who are combating the forces of evil. And there's all kinds of other ways in which the richness of African life ways, many African life ways that came together through the process of enslavement, have enriched and shaped the societies in which where slavery unfolded and where resistance to slavery took place. So the ethics of care are responsive to that. They pay attention to that. They incorporate a deep spirituality around honoring and recognizing the ancestors. There's pouring of libations, whether it's white rum or water or whatever liquid happens to be around. A pouring of a libation is a recognition of those whose shoulders you stand on, whose ancestors struggled, fought, and died for your own freedom today. And so there are all kinds of ways in which these groups are organizing around the ethics of care, whether it's in African indigenous healing circles, whether it is approaches to midwifery, whether it is cultivation of and preservation of herbal remedies, and whether it is the education of youth around all of these things. These are indigenous knowledges and the indigeneity of Maroons, referring to their African life ways, as well as some of the indigenous ways of knowing and being that come from their shared ancestry with First Peoples when they escaped into the hinterlands. So these are what are being revived in this decolonial process, and women are paying attention to those processes that are important for women's health, women's well-being, and which are nurturing and caring for the entire community, and encouraging, this is a feminist aspect of their work, encouraging men to engage in these, in many of these activities as well, in terms of nurturing and caregiving of children, for instance, and working together in decision-making processes around households and community. So I think that's some of the ways in which that process of the ethics of care is contextualized and configured specifically. I think it's always important in feminist discourse to understand the relationship between the broader frameworks and their specificity, how they are articulated, how ways of thinking, whether action points around care, take shape and form in specific spaces. That doesn't mean that there aren't shared aspects across different groups, but we want to understand the way in which they are deployed in response to the specific histories, cultures, and contexts of particular groups.
Thank you, Professor. I think those are very important observations, because one of the things that that kind of engages decolonizing feminist discourses is actually to transcend those boundaries, ethics of care and ethics of justice, you know, the public, the private, masculinity, femininity. Those are important. Those are, it's been a very long time that from, you know, our scholarship, our writings and research, and even trying to address, you know, patriarchies and masculinities, they end up going back to the same categories. So I think these interventions are very important. And the fact that you have kind of, you know, enabled, you know, along with other scholars to actually come to the forefront and be introduced to the audience, you know, there are more and more people who are reading about it, are aware of it. I think those are very important, you know, developments in this. And I think there's something else, you know, which I found very interesting in your work, which is also looking at art forms, you know, art forms as modes of protest and, you know, expressions of protest. And there's a work that you have engaged with, you know, artists in Janakpur, Nepal, you know, women engaging with Mithila art, you know, and they're kind of using these art forms to challenge, you know, the social, economic hierarchies, sexual violence, menstrual taboos, child marriage. In fact, I would like to tell you and the audience that one of the ancient scriptures in India, Ramayana, right? And you have Ram and Sita. So as Ram belongs to Ayodhya, Sita is from Janakpur. So it kind of really, you know, I kind of brought back the stories that, you know, my grandmother used to kind of.
Love the stories of Ram and Sita. Yeah, they're they're powerful, interesting stories.
Yes, and you actually went there and interacted with artists there. So please tell us something about, because art is also a very powerful medium of, you know, of expression of protest and resistance. You know, so please tell us how they look.
I just want to go back to one point about the ethics of care, and one of the ways in which scholarship can become personally empowering, and learning about the scholarship of others can become personally empowering. So I just said that there's this, and you previously said that the ethics of care, of justice are broad frameworks that feminists are harnessing. And so it's important for our audience, our listeners, to think about how those ethics of care, how understanding care itself, what does it mean for women to care for themselves, for one another, for colleagues, to introduce into environments where nurturing and caregiving, even love, are sort of bounded out. What does it mean to bring them back in and to insist that while it may be a feminist social movement tactic to bring these in to transform environments, if these are not traits that belong to only to women, these are human capacities, and it is through the genderization, right, of particular sets of emotions that accompany behaviors that we segregate them into belonging to particular genders, which is why in many societies that are more gender fluid, there is greater opportunity. So for instance, in Native North American two-spirit communities, individuals across many Native American societies that embody elements of the feminine and the masculine, the attributes of the so-called feminine, the so-called masculine are not limited to one or the other, but two-spirits who often historically were shamans sought to cultivate those aspects in men or women who affiliated with one gender or the other, who might have fallen ill because they embodied too much of a masculine characteristic and not enough of a feminine characteristic. So it's a sort of seeking of balance. And so I want to encourage our listeners to think about their own lives in this way? What are the characteristics that have been traditionally associated with, and the emotions and with masculinity and femininity that can be broken out of that mold and embraced by all of us? That is the work. That is the work of deploying scholarship into our everyday lives. And that is what's happening, actually, if I can make a transition to Janakpur and in other in many places around the world, and you know, with what this is often referred to as artivism, you know, the blend of art and activism, right? Artivism. And so I traveled to Janakpur to visit a studio that was run by the well-known Mithila artist Ajit Sah, whom I had met in the United States. It's a whole story, but he invited me to Nepal, and he was working with very poor women who had very challenging situations. He was very empathetic to women who were widowed, to Dalit women, to women who are marginalized for one way or the other, and because of their marginalization was the result of the social structures and hierarchies that placed women from various ethnic groups or widowed women or caste groups into a situation where they struggled to make a living for themselves. Some of them may have had alcoholic husbands, whatever it may be. And he was training them in Mithila art techniques. What's interesting and rather ironic and also a global pattern is that many of the indigenous arts that, arts that were traditionally women's arts, indigenous to women, such as Mithila, where women would distort, you know, paint with their fingers or sticks and things on the walls of buildings to decorate for a ceremony, mythic creatures or whatever it may be, became increasingly masculinized as it became commodified. This has happened with so many things. It's happened with midwifery and the development of the OBGYN field. It happened, you know, that women as healers who were degraded as witches, right, and then hunted, and then while men became professionalized into the field of medicine. So, and the same is true with art, and in this case, Mithila art. But nonetheless, Ajit is, while he's a brilliant Mithila artist, and he has wanted to return the skill to women, to these marginalized women. And so in the process of doing so, some of the women who were producing, I would say, more typical forms of Mithila art, which is a form of storytelling. It's a form of communication, and many of the stories are mythical stories, as you have suggested, but also community stories. What's happening in the community? They turned to some of the new laws that emerged in the 2015 Constitution after Nepal's 10-year civil war, the Maoist civil war. Eventually, with the new constitution, there were certain laws that, for example, outlawed child marriage. So child marriage, though, you know, there's a tension in society always between changing laws and changing practices. And it's often very difficult to change practices when there isn't enforcement or there isn't education about the changing laws. So some of the women in the studio were taking it upon themselves to use Mithila art to communicate about these changing laws. So I wish I had some paintings here to hold up. I have them back at home, but there are examples of some paintings where you would see on one side of the frame, Mithila art has a beautiful border. It starts with the border, and then within the border, there are frames that tell the stories. And in one frame, one particular painting, there's an image of parents being handed a fine by a policeman. And on the other frame, there's a little girl who's sitting on a mat, all dressed up for her marriage ceremony. And in another frame, that little girl is later in school at a desk learning. It tells the story that parents, you know, there's sanctions for this, and instead send your girls to school. So that's one example. So I was very interested in how these women on their own initiative decided to do this, and then began to work with an NGO in the area whose goal, and I don't remember the name of the NGO, but the goal of this organization was to collect many of these forms of art and to put them together on a large banner. And so the banner would tell multiple stories of the new laws that offered liberatory opportunities for girls and women, as well as Dalits and indigenous groups. Nepal is so complex in terms of its many, many groups, and not everybody's happy with the new constitution, but it does provide many opportunities for a number of groups to break out of and away from some of the restricting behaviors that were normative in the Pali society.
Very interesting, conversation we have in terms of looking at activism, you know, as you say, and sometimes, you know, that is a very powerful mode of, resistance and expression. And perhaps something that perhaps women, again, are able to own up, in terms of, and as you're saying, that perhaps there was also certain masculinization of the art form, and then there was a reclaiming. Mm-hmm. So I think those are very interesting, kind of stories which helps us to map, how it is going, and how those what we call as collaborative social change, how that change happened in these moments, that one is able to capture. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think we can do the last question where now, as a feminist anthropologist, as someone who is an activist, what do you still think are the challenges? Where do you think, a few, if you could reflect, right, in the way that we are doing, yeah.
What are some of the our main challenge, as I think many of us know, is the climate emergency. This is the hottest summer on record. It's been the hottest past 15 years. The world is aflame. It's burning in Hawaii. There are fires, all over the place. The seas are warming up. Corals are dying, there's a growing neo-fascist, authoritarian, global movement from the United States, in your own country, Iran, Turkey, so many places, this feminists need to be in the forefront of these movement to challenge these repressive governments and to make very explicit what is not well understood, which is the relationship between economic justice, gender justice, and climate justice, because climate crisis is also a social justice crisis. The most marginalized are the most vulnerable. And so empowerment, justice, opportunities for participating in decision-making. Women are as I think one of your recent guests noted, are the forefront of food production, and which is threatened. And so I think this is our central challenge. And there are so many ways that work can be done in this area, whether it's around subsistence and ecological sustainability, whether it's around equity, equity work, whether it's around anti-violence, anti-racism, anti-fascism, and encouraging participatory, inclusive processes and decision-making. All of these are critical. Women have long been the protectors of environments because they are the ones who are on the front lines of interacting with the non-human world the natural world. And humans have become dispossessed, many of us, from that natural world, denatured. We have to understand that we are part of these processes, and there are many belief systems, spiritualities that can be drawn from to encourage a movement back to understanding our interconnectedness and embeddedness in the world, our interdependence with all other living beings. And I think feminists can be on the forefront of that as well. And encouraging and amplifying the voices of those indigenous groups that are on the front lines of protecting our world. So for me, that is the number one issue. And how people find their way into it, you know, there are many ways to find your way into it. And that's what needs to be done.
All right. I think I'm really, really grateful, Professor Fox. I think this was a very insightful session. We have a global audience, and you know, the issues that you touched upon, the way you kind of took us through the theoretical mapping and the mapping through the eyes of a practitioner, an activist. I think we covered a range in terms of understanding the nature of, not just the nature of gender-based violence, but also today's focus was more in terms of looking at their collective agency of reclaiming, you know, their rights and their dignity and their right to self-determination. And therefore, a very important, I can say, message that really actually came through the session today was that perhaps an intellectual involvement or engagement alone is not enough. You know, it is very important to engage and interact in a way which actually transcends our boundaries too.
Absolutely, you know? We're whole people. We are. We have emotions. We have spiritualities, yes. And we have bodily needs. You know, we have to move forward. Assuming that is the foundation through which we interact with others.
I think in that spirit, you know, perhaps this is the reason why we kind of decided to do this podcast, you know, because we are really trying that we have speakers and scholars from different streams and countries and, you know, and even disciplines, you know, to be able to bring those insights, you know, and perhaps kind of break some of the often dominant narratives, you know, and kind of bring forth, you know, the stories that need to be told, the stories that need to be heard, you know, and therefore, perhaps, you know, as I said, you know, the whole idea of then social change is something that we will be able to capture in a way which is more, deeper, you know. And it is not just, you know, at a level where you cannot really see the complexities and the challenges, intersectionalities, real marginalizations, you know. So those, I think, those that engagement is something which has really come out very well, not just in a huge amount of work that we are doing, but in just the small podcast that we have done today. And I'm really grateful on behalf of Collaborative Social Change. Thank you so much, Professor Fox. As you say, I can address you as Diana, but when I look at you, I'm like, okay, she's really done some good work, you know, there. Hard work.
Thank you. Thank you. for this session. I appreciate it. All the best.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Faux. And, and bye for now to our lovely audience here. And we will be back soon with another episode of the podcast, which looks at gender-based violence, context, and contestations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.